Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Many of us remember that first moment the Fortean hooked its claws into us. Be it a personal experience, a family story, a book in the library, or a TV show. Be it a personal experience, a family story, a book in the library, or a TV show, something mysteriously pulled us into the strange. Now in his new series of books under the Enduring Mysteries title, author, writer, and editor Christopher Barn joins me as we delve into Area 51, Atlantis, Bigfoot, and near-death experiences. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes. And thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support the show. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes and news, and our exclusive merchandise site is available through TeePublic, and you'll find the link for that in the show notes too. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. It's the mysterious we can't explain that seems to pull us in deeper, as Christopher Barn explains. Today, I welcome author Christopher Barn to the show in regards to his captivating new series of books with his Enduring Mysteries collection. From Bigfoot to Atlantis, Area 51 to near-death experiences, Christopher's books aim to get the next generation of weirdos captivated in the legends and lore that drew us into this wonderful subject. Christopher, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you for having me. This is great to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. There are many things in life that I'm a great admirer of. And I think anybody that attempts to hook young readers into reading, first of all, and especially, as I would imagine, we're of a similar vintage. We seem to have been quite spoilt growing up by the amount of paranormal resources and collections that we had available to us, either through relatives or libraries, Christopher. It really took me back to those heady days of being a young man and discovering these books squirreled away in secret sections of the library. Are you delighted with how these have turned out and the feedback to them? Because it does seem that for a lot of people, they seem to have taken our generation back to those halcyon days when we first came across these subjects.
I am really just thrilled by the reception that the books have gotten. And, you know, when I got the assignment from the publisher to write them, I thought, this is exactly something that I'm interested in, because, you know, when I was... They're designed to be introductions to various paranormal topics for younger people, or maybe even grown-ups who don't know much about the subject and want to know the basics of, you know, Bigfoot or Loch Ness Monster or whatever. And I just remember being 12, being that age, and going down to the library and parking myself in front of the paranormal section and reading anything I could get my hands on about that stuff. I loved, there was a show that Leonard Nimoy did called In Search Of back in those days. I don't know if you had it in England, but I was a huge fan of that. And I was excited to be able to write something that the 12-year-old me would have wanted to read, and that's what I was shooting for.
I suppose it's one of those strange things. I mean, In Search Of is probably the pantheon of that kind of investigative show that we had, and I kind of missed it when it was first shown here. It's one of those strange things about British TV is obviously we take a lot of American content, from soap operas to detective shows to documentaries these days, it would seem. In Search Of was shown when I was a very young child, before I was able to stay up to the lateness it was allowed on here. But it's never been repeated. And if it has, I think I saw one episode that was on about 3:30 on a morning one day in the early 1990s. And so I'd never really seen it until I stumbled across the entire collection on YouTube, which is no longer there, sadly. And so I watched them all about 10 years ago, and I absolutely loved it. And I can understand why so many people really hold that show dear to their hearts, because not only was it very varied in regards to the topics it covered, I mean, it did things like Anastasia, which is one of those mysteries that doesn't seem to get covered a lot these days. I remember chuckling at seeing one about the impending Ice Age, which is obviously a very different thing to how people view things 45 years on. But it had loads of stories about the paranormal and Bigfoot and mysteries and things like that. And I think for people, like I say, growing up, we always had these kind of enduring mysteries that I think, do you think that's because people seem to think that content has purely moved digitally, whereas I think, once again, this is the presumption that everybody has access to the internet or safe resources, Christopher, and therefore books like these, for me, are incredibly important for young people.
Yeah, I know when I was researching the books, I went down to the library and I got as many as I could recent. I was looking for, you know, new material as much as I could, but I was also trying to clue people into the history of it as well. If you want to tell the story of Bigfoot, you have to tell them about the Patterson-Gimlin film and where all that is coming from. So hopefully this is answering your question, but I really wanted to give people a sense of what the Bigfoot story is, how it had evolved over time, what the science was, and give people a full picture of what everything was about.
I suppose one of the biggest decisions, I would imagine, when you look at creating a series of this in conjunction with the publisher, Christopher, is the subjects you're going to tackle. Obviously, there are 6 books in this series so far. Based on this, I hope there's another 6 at least. Was it one of those conscious kind of to and fro discussions about the topics, or had the publisher already kind of said, these are the things we want to focus on? Because there's 2 or 3, I would say, that I would not expect a series to focus on. And I'm really glad you have, because I think these are the kind of subjects that don't get as much attention these days, which is probably Area 51, Atlantis, and near-death experience.
Mm-hmm.
Were these subjects that you were quite happy with? Or like I say, was there a bit of to and fro in regards to when you were drawing up the plans of how to attack this?
Well, when the publisher brought me on, they had already decided what the 6 books were going to be, because they were doing new editions of, they had published these 6 books maybe 15 years ago, and they wanted to get a fresh take on them. And so what I did was I re-researched them from the ground up and tried to make them as new and compelling as I could. And some of them, you know, near-death experiences, I wasn't sure where I was going to start with that one until I dove into the research. And it was very interesting to me how much real science has been done in the past, you know, 15, 20 years or so. Obviously it's an extremely difficult topic for science to get into, because researching near death on humans is a very tricky thing to do. You can't bring your people near death. That's not considered cool. But there, people have been researching as best as they can what happens to the brain during extreme experiences where, you know, perhaps people are having a heart attack or a coma or something like that, and where they can safely get the information. They've found a lot of interesting things about how a near-death experience might relate to the brain state of dreaming and all of that. There are certain questions that can't be answered, of course, especially with something like near-death experiences. because what does happen after death is, after a certain point, that's unanswerable. You're not going to know until you get there. But we found out a lot, more than I would have expected when I started researching that, about what happens near that point.
It is fascinating, like you say. I think with you looking at these books being released 15 years ago and looking at, like you say, building them back up from the ground up, which is, once again, a very refreshing take, Chris. I'm amazed at how much work's been done on NDEs in that period as well. It is remarkable. And I think it's one of those, well, it's the big question, isn't it? I think it's like, why are so many people interested in hauntings and ghosts? Because it's all about what happens at the end, I think. Mm-hmm. It's the ultimate question that none of us have an answer for, regardless of our personal biases or our belief systems or whichever, if we're religious and whichever denomination we decide to follow. Everyone has a certain opinion about what goes on. And I think when you read that particular book, it's very refreshing, because I think it's an excellent topic to cover amongst all these, because it seems to be one of those things that often we try not to cover, death or loss or grief with teenagers, which I find is a very strange concept, I think, because often it's a very tumultuous period in young people's lives, and it's usually the time when they do lose somebody close to them, be it an elderly relative or a friend or whatever. It can be a very lonely situation, and I think looking at that book and the way it's written, I mean, and this permeates the whole series, there is a level of intellect prescribed to the person that's going to be reading this book, Christopher, like you say. You know, it's the kind of book I would have wanted to read at 12, because it challenged me a little and it made me think far more. Whereas sometimes you can pitch a book at a certain level and it's kind of wishy-washy a little bit and it kind of dances around it. Whereas that one precisely is full of excellent facts. Some of the researchers, you've got some incredible cases that don't often get mentioned, Ernest Hemingway's especially. Mm-hmm. And it opens up the doors to other things. And I think this is the great thing about all the books in this particular series. They're very open-ended. You give a great overview and dive into some key points in each of the subjects that you tackle in this series. But it fires you up, and even as someone as well-read as myself, and obviously as well-read as you are, as I can see from behind you, Christopher, I love a book that makes you want to read other books. And every single one you've released here in this part of this collection is clearly a massive jumping-off point for whichever avenue they want to go in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, each of the books are fairly short. They're only 48 pages. They're all about 8,000 words. And so I knew that I didn't have time to delve into any one subject too deeply, but I tried to include as many fun stories. You know, I went through research materials, finding as many Bigfoot tales of Bigfoot encounters as I could, and pulling out the ones that were most interesting or maybe had a particular historical interest. I made sure to include some of the ones I remembered as a kid, like the Ape Canyon event, or the, I'm forgetting his name, but the guy who was kidnapped by the Bigfoot family.
Oh,
I remember reading that as a kid. And then I kept finding interesting things that I didn't know about. I didn't know about Theodore Roosevelt's Bigfoot story, which is incredible and so well written. If you go back and find the original book called The Wilderness Hunter by Theodore Roosevelt is available online, and it's worth taking a look for. He was a great storyteller.
Mm. Yeah, it's certainly not one to read at night, though. It's a very hair-raising story.
Yes, for sure.
it's in that pantheon of, I really like Bigfoot, I'm not particularly happy about these personal experiences. A bit like Ape Canyon. Ruby Creek is another one, which is very similar. The kind of, mm-hmm. Yes, good luck to whoever's involved in that particular case. I suppose, and whilst we're talking about it, and you mention it there, I suspect whilst you were pulling all the titles together, you were stumbling on things that even with someone with your interest throughout your life and your connections to pop culture and the way that you've written throughout your career, you were still discovering things at this point in your life in these subjects that a lot of people might think, well, surely we know everything we need to know. But I think it's one of those things. It's all about what access you've had to these particular subjects, I think, and who's telling those stories, Christopher, because sometimes people can kind of gatekeep things, or they'll make a decision on what's important. Like you say, one of the key aspects was to try and include as much fun in regards to some of the stories under the subjects you were covering.
Yeah, well, I mean, fun was primary, one of the primary things. I mean, the educational merit was obviously one of the main things as well. But if the books aren't fun, no one's going to want to read them, and I'm not going to want to write them. So you have to make sure that that you're enjoying yourself as you're doing it. But there is so much that's, you know, as you know from hosting so many of these podcasts, these subjects are just inherently fun. And if you can zero in on that stuff and collect as much of it as you can, that's a big part of interesting. You know, one of the aims of the books is simply to get kids interested in reading at all. And if the books are fun, then hopefully that will achieve its aim. If they also learn something, well, I tried to put in as much science as I could. I wanted to be, you know, the Patterson-Gimlin film is obviously a very controversial thing, and, you know, a lot of the other Bigfoot encounters, they have, you know, proponents and detractors on one side and the other. Some things have been proven to be hoaxes, others are open-ended, and I tried to be clear as to sort of what the status of the legend is. But that doesn't mean that you don't talk about the legend, because the legend is the whole subject. And they're interesting, you know, even if you're not a believer in this stuff, and I'm not, in most of these cases, I'm more of a Scully than a Mulder, if you will. That doesn't mean that they're not interesting cultural phenomenon or pop culture phenomenon. You know, I was an entertainment journalist for a long time, and so that whole aspect of that, first of all, that training helped me write the books, but also it's part of what interests me, you know, as a fan of monster movies, but also how monster movies are made. I'm interested in how do the stories get told, how do the Bigfoot legends, where did they start, where did the Loch Ness Monster really get its start? How did that story evolve? It was very interesting to see that, as far as I can tell, 1933 is when most of the Loch Ness Monster tales really blossomed, which is the same year that King Kong came out with that fantastic sequence of the brontosaur rising from the swamp and attacking the sailors. And it's right around that time that most of the tales of the Loch Ness Monster begin to form into a plesiosaur-shaped monster, at least from what I can tell. I think you probably know more about the lore than I do. But
it's certainly a key ingredient in that. Absolutely. I've spoken to people who think that the hoax explanation for the surgeon's photo is also a hoax, because there's no evidence to support what they say. They've just basically said, oh, well, this is what my father did. But they can't prove it. There's no evidence other than them saying it. And you always get that one clipped image of it. They don't show the big image where you can see the other bank of the lock behind it. So it's, yeah, it's, you know, and as someone that's had the honour of visiting Loch Ness, I mean, it is the kind of place you would imagine a monster would live. I mean, obviously, compared to the lakes you guys have not far from you, it's a bit more than a puddle, going on the size of some of the sizable lakes you have in your wonderful systems there between the borders of America and Canada. It's incredible. But and as someone who loves these monsters, I find far more compelling stories about lake monsters from Lake Champlain, Lake Okanagan, you know, Ogopogo and things like that. There seems to be a lot more to those, I think, purely because those bodies of water are so big, Christopher. Whereas Loch Ness, yes, it's the biggest freshwater expanse we've got here, and every other body of water in England and Wales can fit inside Loch Ness. but Loch Ness is still relatively small in comparison to other countries. But it's incredible, like you say, that, you know, we're nearly 100 years since it became fashionable to see Nessie. And it kind of comes and goes. I think it's one of those ones that seems to come around in circles of fashion. And yet it still shows that the pull of Nessie is still there for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's one thing that was interesting in all of these books is that the stories never die out. They change when they sort of need to. I thought it was really interesting to discover that as wilderness areas decrease, there's less space for Bigfoot to be hiding in. And the idea that Bigfoot is an extra-dimensional being is an interesting, you know, maybe that's true, but it could be just an interesting pop cultural evolution of that idea to still give us space somewhere on the planet, or perhaps just off the planet, for Bigfoot to still live. Because we want Bigfoot in our world. We want the idea that creatures like this are just over the horizon.
Absolutely. I think it's the joy of mystery.
Yeah.
It's the possibility, isn't it? It's that's what the tantalizing thing, I think, for all of us. And it is fascinating. I think you can kind of see some of these ideas adapting. I mean, obviously, as you say there are numerous theories about why we can't catch a Bigfoot. It's a strange one, and it does seem sometimes that people tend to leap to very strange, far out ideas. But some people are absolutely convinced by that. Some people are convinced that they're aliens, and that's why we can't catch them, because they don't live here. I've seen numerous explanations for it over the years. I have to say I tend to fall into one side of it, but that doesn't mean I'm right and everybody else is wrong. And I think often, as with any subject like this, there are lots of people that like to consider themselves experts, but nobody is really. You are just very well read or knowledgeable. And I think looking at these in kind of a very open-minded way, as you say, in how the books have been presented and written, allows the reader to get a thirst for it, like you say. And with them being so varied, it can take you in all kinds of directions. When I looked at the titles, I have to say, I think the one that probably is a prime example of probably a more modern mystery that's come to the fore, really, is obviously Area 51, which is probably the least secret base in the world, really, because we all know where it is.
Yep.
And yet, it in the 90s, when obviously I was listening to Art Bell and reading magazines and stuff, it was always given this kind of mystical sort of like it was 2,000 years ago in the age of the pharaohs,
yeah,
or something.
And it's not even... It was known about it in pop culture. I was watching that old giant ant movie, Them,
yes,
which was 1955, I believe, and they mentioned Groom Lake in there, yeah, as a possibility of where the ants came from. I had no idea that it was that public that early, so it was interesting.
Yeah, well,
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh no, do not apologize. You're quite all right. It's me. I'll shut up. You're the guest. But like you say, I think when you've got a love of monster movies as well, especially the 50s, because every, you know, who wasn't dropping atomic weapons somewhere where they shouldn't, that were creating the local wildlife to go bananas? I mean, I love all that whole sort of post-Godzilla explosion, pardon the pun, in giant monsters, you know, from mantises to birds to ants to spiders. They were everywhere attacking people. And like you say, often it would be, oh no, what if the government have been testing something at this secret location and the radiation has caused everything to turn into giants and then we have to try and fix it. And so, there are, like you said, there are these little tantalising clues like that, like the White Sands testing ground. If you look at some of the early UFO stuff from that sort of late 40s, early 50s period, there's things happening there as well, which then ties into like Roswell and leads into Area 51 later down the line. But it is surprising. It's like we've got these breadcrumbs that are littered through popular culture. And it's always been interesting for me because there are some people who are absolutely adamant that this is kind of like a drip feeding of disclosure in regards to certain subjects, Christopher, that the authorities, the people in power have always known that we're not alone, be it monsters or aliens or whatever. And it's the media that's sort of allowed us to become more open-minded to the possibilities that when it happens, it won't be as much as of a shock as, say, if it happened in 1948, for example.
I mean, those are definite possibilities. That's one of the things about this subject, just speaking in general about the paranormal. The thing that remains interesting about it is that it always lives in that area right between truth and not truth. Is it real or is it not? It lives in the what if. So the idea of Area 51, for example, I think part of the reason that that has remained interesting beyond anything having to do with the actual things that are going on there is that it's sort of a focal point for what is questions about what is our government doing, what secret planes are they building, you know, that sort of thing. Any questions about that, they tend to focus on Area 51.
For some, it kind of symbolizes the nefarious machinations of government, I think, Christopher. Mm-hmm. But I think for a lot of people, it's now kind of become kind of the distraction. And so everybody's focusing, looking in at Area 51, going, oh, well, what's going on here? Whereas the government are somewhere else with Lockheed Martin, building the next generation of super fighters or space weapons or whatever, somewhere completely different that nobody's got any idea on, because everybody's convinced, especially because you've got people like Bob Lazar as well, who have constantly kept that Area 51 story going for, I don't know, the best part of 35 years, I think it was, since Bob appeared on George Knapp's TV show back in late 80s, I think that was. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be one of those that it comes in cycles once again, like we were saying about Nessie. I think that every time you think Area 51's done, somebody pops up and goes, actually, I work there and this is what happens. And you see that all the time with that. So I think especially as certain conspiracies have kind of powered their way across the internet as well, it all kinds of wraps itself up. I think people are getting themselves so twisted to work out what the hell is going on, but they're actually missing what is going on because they're looking at the wrong thing now.
That's certainly possible. I mean, one thing is that a great story just refuses to die. the Area 50, the sort of the core, if you boil it down to a couple of paragraphs, the core story of Area 51 is still interesting and fascinating all the way over the years. And so if something new comes up, or somebody comes up with a new wrinkle on it or discovers something new, it revives interest in the entire corpus of material. And that's one of the reasons that these stories still live.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
I suppose when you were researching these, as you said, you're a skeptical believer, right? I mean, that's a perfectly acceptable standpoint to have, I think, often, as with anything in life. And it's good to be open-minded, but it's also good to have that balance as well. And especially with some of these subjects, there are very different levels, shall we say, on each one of plausibility, I think, sometimes, Christopher. There are times when I read or listen to things and I take a sharp intake of breath because it's even a bit too weird for me. And so I'm intrigued as to, from starting the book to having them published, is there anything where through your research and you're pulling together these books that you've kind of considered the possibilities a bit more, or it's made you even more intrigued, even as an adult, to think it's kind of fired up that childlike wonder in you again to look into what is going on with Atlantis? Why does it keep moving around the world? And why, once again, why is it one of those stories that still keeps coming back? Like you say, it's a fabulous story, but there's very, very little meat on those bones, shall we say.
Well, I think Atlantis interested me more than anything because of the constant evolution of the stories about Atlantis. It's such a, it's sort of a broad topic, and people have been able to bring their own ideas to it, changing the story. It's influenced Namor the Submariner and Aquaman. It's influenced all kinds of stories about, you know, people have gone, I believe that's where the hollow world hypothesis evolved from, is stories of Atlantis, trying to think about where Atlantis might be. It's really gone into all kinds of very interesting places. As far as researching the books and finding myself thinking, that's more plausible than I thought, I would have to say Near-Death Experiences was the one where, first of all, like I was saying earlier, I did not realize just how much real research has been done on this, on the topic, and how people are researching how the brain works. But that's also an area where I've had a couple of uncanny experiences myself. Having dreams the night after a loved one dies, and you know, the stories themselves are not necessarily interesting enough for the show, but I did have them. And it's one of those things where you can't fully explain why, what happened or why it might have happened. And no one knows exactly what's going to happen to you after death. Is there a soul or an electric field or something that leaves your body and can still somehow communicate with the people that you care about afterwards? I don't know, but I've had a couple of experiences that make me think maybe, but they could just be coincidental dreams.
I think it is fascinating because, with the greatest respect, I don't think we really know that much about the brain. We certainly know a lot more than we did even 20 years ago, as you referred to. And it is remarkable just how much work is going on here, because I think there's so much baggage tied up with NDEs. I think that one of the great things in your particular volume that covers that particular subject is the fact that you explain it very simply, but also refer to the scientific terms and the work that's gone on, and some of the very important people in regards to this research, and the fact that it is going on in countless establishments and institutions around the world as we speak. It is, for some, it is the ultimate question that needs to be answered regardless, I think, because we're essentially flesh-coloured batteries, and nobody understands where that goes at the end. Where does that energy dissipate to, like you say? And as we learn more and our technology advances and our ability to be able to read the brain in various states, be it in comas, being awake, when people have had very traumatic head injuries, these kinds of things, I'm always fascinated by this because, it doesn't seem to be the same for everybody. I mean, you talk about like people who have been struck by lightning, for example. Mm-hmm. Most people, yes, it's going to kill you. And yet there are hundreds, if not probably thousands of people around the world throughout time who have been struck by lightning, and it's had profound impact on their life. And very similar to NDEs, there's clearly something that happens for whatever reason to certain people in certain situations where it's almost as if the brain's rewired itself. And I know when you talk about things like people being struck by lightning, there are so many stories of people whose personalities have changed. They've discovered artistic talents they never had. I was watching a documentary the other week about a guy who got struck by lightning, and he was blind and deaf, and it rewired his internal nervous system, and he could basically started to see again. His hearing came back and his hair grew back. He'd gone bald. He'd got the triple whammy. And yet most people, you get struck by lightning, that's the end of it. There's nothing coming back from that. And so I was interested when I was reading that particular section in the near-death experience book, Christopher, that you mentioned some of the changes and some of the studies that have gone on, that people seem to basically have no fear of death after they've had an NDE. For whatever reason, it's almost as if they think, well, I've seen what happens and I'm fine. I'm going to be okay. But that has this kind of snowball effect in their personal lives, mm-hmm. that families fall apart. They start taking risky behavior. They become more reckless for some reason. And that's a really interesting aspect of it, because as you were saying, if it's just a dream, why is it having that much of an effect on people? People have bad dreams. People have great dreams. But there aren't many people who have a dream and it completely changes their life within a matter of weeks.
Yeah, that was very interesting. I mean, Hemingway was part of that, as I think you mentioned. There was, I'm blanking on his name, but the man who had a near-death experience and discovered he could play piano also lost his fear of death, but not in a great way. It didn't have a good effect in his life. He kept getting into situations where he nearly got himself killed because he lacked the caution anymore. And it didn't seem like that aspect of it was positive for him. So these, you know, and perhaps understandably, because in order to have had a near-death experience, you have to have had some extreme trauma. And that's going to leave, you know, that's going to leave its marks on you. So perhaps he was still working through the negative aspects of that. And, you know, of course, Hemingway, I think his near-death experience in World War I, he was shot and nearly killed. And I believe he mentioned that he felt his soul fly out of his body, zoom around for a while, and then go back in. And if you look at his writing, that clearly had a huge effect on everything that he wrote. And of course, if you remember his biography, he didn't deal with that all that well in the end either. He ended up committing suicide. And he was, I'm not saying that the NDE was the only cause of his troubles, because he was a troubled person, but clearly it had profound effect on him in a negative way as well as a positive way.
I think it is. It's intriguing. I think there are numerous examples that you give in that particular book of very famous cases. I mean, I forget the chap's name, but he was found unconscious in a park and they thought he was dead and they never gave up on him. And I think he ended up going into a medically induced coma. But I had to chuckle when they were on about the bit where the nurse took his dentures out, put him in a drawer. Whilst he was unconscious, and technically he was dead. And then when he came round, he wanted to know where his dentures were and pointed out which particular drawer and which nurse had taken them, which I'm sure some people would explain away as, well, he was listening, so he knew who it was. But that is one of those things that happens in these particular kinds of cases that you really scratch your head and think, is it really as simple as that? Because that seems a bit of a leap to say, oh, well, he just remembered it.
Who can say? I remember that story. The reason that you can't remember his name is because his name wasn't in the book. The doctor left his name out, I believe, for privacy reasons. But yeah, I mean, there are so many common elements to these stories that it's very interesting that the common elements could be there in because it means they're all true. You know, they have the common elements because that's what happens when these things happen, and that's real. Or it could be received pop cultural wisdom about, this is what's supposed to happen when I'm having an experience, and so I remember it that way. Or it could just be, like, I remember going to the dentist and getting nitrous oxide, breathing a little too much of it in, and suddenly realizing, quote-unquote, realizing that the world was not real. And that was not me having a revelation. That was me being on nitrous oxide. And, you know, especially with the near-death experience, it's possible that, you know, people are having a traumatic time, they're having a traumatic experience, and it's possible that their brain is reacting to a lack of oxygen or other medical trauma, you know, being hit on the head very hard or something like that. And maybe that's what happened, is the people, your brain is trying to process what's happening to you, but the thing in your head that helps you do that is impaired. And so maybe that's a common element of that. But we really don't know one way or another. I mean, that's what the hardcore skeptics would say. But is that what's actually happening? It's very difficult to say. And that's one of the things that I think drives... if you take all six of these books and sort of the paranormal topic in general as like a pop culture phenomenon, I forget if I already said this, but they sort of live in that space between what is and what isn't, what is, we don't know, what if. That's the thing that drives continuing interest in these for me.
Mm, very much so. I mean, the Jung story as well, that's in the NDE book, is one of those that, once again, I've got a wry smile in it, because only Jung would have an NDE where he would basically focus on someone else popping up and thinking, oh, well, it's bad for me, but it's probably going to be worse for you, which was because he believed that seeing his own doctor in it meant that his doctor was going to die. And he did. He died of blood poisoning a few weeks later, I believe. Which is typical. This is the kind of thing I would expect Jung. If it wasn't Jung, it would be Freud. I would imagine they would have such a similar experience where, yes, things are really bad for them, but they meet somebody else and it's going to be a lot worse for them. And so even when you have people of that magnitude of intellect who seem to be unable to distinguish whether this is a fantasy or reality, when you have little things in it, as I mentioned about the dentures, or the personality changes or everything, these are not the things that can just be prescribed by hallucinations. And it's also, it's one of those things, I think, that just because people hallucinate doesn't necessarily explain everything. And I think,
yes,
as with all mysteries, most of them are not a one-size-fits-all. You can kind of say, well, I think this explains that portion of it, but it doesn't explain this bit. And sometimes people will just go, well, I don't want to talk about that one because I can't explain it. Whereas, yes, I think there are a lot of misunderstandings or deliberate misrepresentation of what happened. And once again, you touch on two particular books that have been written in fairly recent years, in the last 20 years, both of which are quite controversial. One especially because it was a completely made-up story. That was falsified for the child to have attention, sold over 1 million copies worldwide, and then he came clean, I think, as a young adult, and said, "Yeah, I just made it up because I wanted my family to notice me," and so the publisher pulled it and everything. And so, as we were saying about belief systems and things like that, that alone shows you that how many people hold on to that belief system in regards to what happens next, because that's what they want. And so, unfortunately, there will always be people, as with any mystery or unanswered question, who will use it to take advantage of people who just want to believe in something.
Yeah. Those two books that you're talking about, I thought it was important to include them in the Near-Death Experiences book because of the fact that they were controversial. And, you know, even wherever you come down on the skeptic versus non-skeptic, you have to know that there are going to be people who are scammers or charlatans or making it up just to make money. And you sort of have to be able to protect yourself from that a little bit, right? And it was important to mention those books in part because they hadn't had such a big success. And then to sort of explain, well, you know, not everything, you can't trust everything blindly. You have to bring, you know, so you have to bring your judgment to it, if that makes sense.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I think sometimes it's different. I think one of the boy who came back from heaven was the controversial one, I think. Mm-hmm. and I think the chap, the young lad was called Alex. But it happens. I mean, I'm not going to suggest that I'm the most well-read person in that particular subject. There are countless stories like that in that particular mm-hmm. field, I think, that there are people who are clearly focusing on taking advantage of people. Essentially, it would be like renting a boat, Christopher, and saying, right, come with me, I know where Atlantis is, and just taking people out wherever you decided it was. Because since I've been interested in strangeness, Atlantis seems to have moved all over the place. I've seen it near Antarctica, Australia, it's in the Pacific. No, it's in the Atlantic. Well, actually, it's in the Mediterranean. Actually, we've decided it's actually on Africa, and this is where it is. And so even for someone who started very sceptical in regards to even then as a child, thinking, this sounds a bit too weird, now I'm a bit like, well, I know a bit more about the world now, and I think there might be a grain of truth in it, but I don't think it was this mysterious island in the middle of the Atlantic. I'm one of those people I hang my hat on and the end of their cult because they made the misfortune of living on a volcano that decided to erupt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, to me, reading about Atlantis, and I hadn't realized when I began researching that one that it all started with Plato and there really wasn't anything before Plato's story.
Yeah.
And that Plato's story wasn't necessarily meant to be a history. He was not a historian. He was a philosopher, and he tended to make up parables, I guess, more than anything else, to prove whatever philosophical point he was trying to make in what he was writing. And we don't know for sure if he had found real facts about Atlantis from... supposedly, he got it fifth hand from... a story that was told to his ancestors 200 years earlier. And so things may have, some facts may have been distorted along the way even then. But we don't know for sure if he was even trying to tell a real story about a real island. But it was such an interesting story that it kept going. I tend to believe that if there was a real Atlantis, that it was probably... the Minoans and the island of Thera, because that sort of fits Plato's story. You have to adjust a few things here and there, the math of how big the island was and things like that, but it basically fits. And it was a genuine island that was destroyed by a volcano, and it collapsed not only that civilization but many of the ones near it, because it was such a huge eruption. And it would have been strange if that hadn't wound up in mythology and history of the time. So it makes sense to me that Plato would be writing about it later. Mm. And I think it would have been maybe 900 years after the eruption that Plato was writing his. But the stories that flowed out of the Atlantis myth later, even if you don't necessarily think they're true, it's very interesting to see how that stayed alive and how it inspired people to tell new stories, how it inspired Jules Verne, and how it inspired, all the people that came after them.
Mm. I mean, I think that's the thing, because they're probably the best candidate, because they were obviously a very well-established culture in that particular area. Obviously, the Minoans, for anybody who doesn't really know that much about them, was the basis of where the Minotaur was. These are tangible, real people that existed. I'm not suggesting that they're a half man, half bull living in a maze on their island, but we've only just started to rediscover certain aspects of their culture in the last 15, 20 years. And you look at some of the frescoes that have survived somehow, and the pottery and things, and very similar to some of the changes that happened in that era and that area. Sparta is a prime example of a culture that were, some would say, typically Greek, really. They were very cultured. They were into art and sport, writing and philosophy and poetry. And somehow, over a 200-year period, they went from that part of their culture to being completely obsessed with war and invasion. And it seemed to almost give everything up. It's a very strange part. So there was clearly a lot going on there. And I think when you've got such knowledgeable peoples who are writing, talking, performing at that period, an event such as a volcanic eruption, especially in a place that's still prone to volcanic eruptions and earthquakes regularly. Obviously, we've got Europe's two most active ones are down there in Italy, which isn't too far away from the Greek islands in the Mediterranean. There's a lot goes on there. And obviously, Santorini's had some terrible tremors this year already.
Mm-hmm.
There is a big history of cataclysmic events in that part of Europe. That, to me, makes more sense. And like you say, I think it seems to be one of those that, depending on who's telling that particular story, how they add and build things onto the legend of it, really, Christopher. It's as you touched on there, it becomes whatever it wants to be for the person who's proposing a theory, because you look at these, some of the discussions about it, about them being so far ahead of their time as if to be rulers of the earth, but there's no evidence for that. And it's where do these strands begin? But as you also say, the influence it's had on popular culture and this kind of wonder that we've always had about finding lost worlds, be they on the surface or underground, where we could find cavemen still running around or dinosaurs living in a valley, or giant creatures or strange passages to other magical kingdoms. It's something I think that's been with us for the best part of 150, 200 years.
Oh, I would say much longer than that. I think the Greek myths are probably, the story of Odysseus is almost a classic example of, if you tell that story today, you might have him traveling in a spaceship from planet to planet to planet, because that would be the proper setting for a modern day version.
Yes.
But back then, the story of Odysseus is the hero traveling to unknown places and discovering unknown things. And they loved it. When was that written? 3,000 years ago? They loved it then. We love it now in all of its multifarious forms.
Mm. Ironically, there was a Japanese children's television program in the late 70s, early 80s that did that exact thing. They turned it into a space opera. and so that was essentially, it was called Odysseus, as you might think. But that was all set in space. But it was essentially the same kind of story. And it is remarkable how, even into this day and age, I think the Greek and Roman myths, you can see their influence. Even as you touched on earlier on when we were talking about Atlantis, how even superheroes like Aquaman and the Submariner are both based in and around Atlantis, and they are the kings of the sea, and it's always been there. For anybody who's into Marvel and DC comics, these are concepts that they've been well aware of for decades, really, since both characters appeared. It's their home bases, and for a variety of reasons. So the influence of it is probably not as in your face as perhaps it would have been 20 years ago, but it only takes one more discovery somewhere in that particular location, and you probably suggest that it's going to fire that all up again. Because I think telling the story of Atlantis 100 years ago to now is very different because of the giant leaps we've made in archaeology and being able to carbon date things and being able to preserve things that would have been lost, and the fact that we're still discovering incredible pieces of knowledge that seem to have been lost for years. You only look at the amount of work that's going on at Pompeii still, and that's almost 2,000 years ago since that went up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one thing that's interesting about the Atlantis story is that there's a couple of different sort of pathways that it takes. There's the legend of Atlantis as the lost magical kingdom of enormous splendor and great advancement, and it disappears, and what happens to it. And that part of the story doesn't necessarily have to do with the sea. Mm. So you get Atlantis showing up in all these different possible places because no one knows where it really was. Maybe it was deep underground, maybe it was in Turkey, or maybe it was in Spain or wherever it might be. But then you've got the sea aspect, and the sea is an endless source of mystery. Poems have been written about it, and It's gigantic in a way that is difficult for people. It's literally unfathomable, if you will pardon the pun. And we still don't know, even to this day, we know very little about what's down there. You know, the coelacanth, the fish from, there was a fish that lived earlier than the dinosaurs. When the dinosaurs were hit by the asteroid, the coelacanth was there, and they thought it had died out, but they found it off the coast of South Africa, I believe, just 100 years ago. And we don't know if there's more things. In fact, we almost certainly haven't discovered some incredible things that live down there. And the whole idea of Atlantis dovetails with that mystery. If there's a way for humans to live there, or intelligent beings to live there, it's a way for us to tell stories, and humans love to tell stories of one way or another. Sometimes those are, you know, Aquaman and Namor are heroes, but we've also got H.P. Lovecraft and his creatures from the shadow over Innsmouth, where they're monsters. Yes. That are actually out to get you. And there's room for that in the ocean, too. I mean, Jaws was such a big hit, in part because it sort of represents the whole mystery of the ocean.
Well, absolutely. And I think you can tie that with one of the other titles, which is Sea Monsters, because mm-hmm. these are, you know, stories of leviathans have been around as long as people have sailed the seas, regardless of, mm-hmm. of whether we're talking about people from Greece, people from China, people from the Americas, the Vikings especially. There are countless tales of people encountering very strange things, and often people will come along, as we were saying earlier on, people will come along with very prosaic explanations about things. I mean, the whale penis thing was the big thing about 3 years ago, which is great if you don't know anything about sea monsters and some of the accounts. But then you look at some of the accounts from very experienced men of the sea, and I'm sorry, they're not describing a whale's penis. They're describing very distinct creatures that are acting in very strange things. There are numerous shapes and sizes, colours. Once again, sometimes a simple explanation comes along. And I always find these kind of frustrating because, once again, they explain some. And I'm sure, no doubt, Chris, that there's been misidentification of that. That, you know, it's not an experience I want to go through myself. That is not something I want to see whilst I'm at sea, I have to say. I can live without that experience. But I suppose the fact that even in this day and age, in 2025, we know so very little about what lives in the deep ocean, and we're still discovering incredible creatures, and the whole, like you say, with it being unfathomable, the fact that we have creatures on this planet that can exist at such depths that would completely just explode us due to the pressure, sometimes it is a thing that I cannot get my head around, that you have these things. Or you have these weird creatures that live on volcanic vents, the way the water temperature is 500 degrees centigrade or whatever. And you've got all kinds of things bobbing about thinking, oh, well, this is fine. And it just shows you, I think, that the possibility there, I think, far outweighs anything that we could rediscover or finally find on land, I think.
I think finding out what is actually in the sea, discovering the strange, the giant squids and the colossal squid and things like that, that's just endlessly fascinating. As you mentioned, the volcanic vents, because to me, one of the things that's just mind-boggling is how much life can adapt to live in strange conditions. And it begins to raise questions of if life can exist in those places here on Earth, maybe out in outer space, maybe there is more of a chance for life in outer space. Maybe we should be looking at, we're looking for Earth-like planets now with, you know, our telescopes. Maybe we should broaden that a little bit and think about where life might be found in other planets. That's, you know, these things all sort of tie together in that way. One idea bounces to another. But even if the... Even putting aside the stories of sea monsters, the idea of what the life is in the oceans is fascinating and wonderful. And so I tried to include... I think there's a whole quarter of the book, of the sea monsters book, that just talks about how is the sea organized, what are the levels, what lives in the different areas, how much different is it than other life on land. And part of that was going back to the whole mission of all of this stuff is new to the audience that I'm trying to reach, which is 12 to 14 year olds especially, and also any interested adult that might want to know. So I wanted to really dive into that. But backing up a little bit, you were mentioning stories of sea monsters as being part of folklore. And they really have been. If you think about how long humans have been sailing, it's much longer than you might think. Humans have been living in Australia for something like 50,000 years, if I remember right. You can't get there except on a boat.
Yes.
So, and that's 50,000 years. I wouldn't have thought that, without doing a little research, I wouldn't have known that we were building boats even at that time. But we were, and if we were, then we were seeing whales and giant squid and other things as they went over the waves. And so that's been part of the folklore for before any of the languages that we speak now were intelligible. I mean, English is only 500 years old in its modern form, something like that. And that's, what is that, 1,000 times as long as Australians have been in Australia. So that it's been that long that we've had tales of sea monsters from people seeing actual sea monsters, maybe only a tiny bit of a whale, and wondering, what was that? What just passed by our boat? Because it's not like they could lift it out of the water and get a good look. So, yeah, endless mystery and, just people trying to scientifically find explanations for what they see and giving it their best shot. And that's part of where the legends come from. And it's not only people trying to explain things. Sometimes you tell stories as, for all the reasons that we tell stories now, you tell stories to tell a moral lesson or just to entertain. And you come up with a giant monster that would rise out of the sea because you think it's cool. Well, I would tell a story like that now. I'm sure there was somebody 40,000 years ago that would tell a story like that too, because I'm sure there was a guy like me back then. At least I hope.
Absolutely. I mean, I often find it baffling, Christopher, that people don't seem to deal with that, like you say, about how long we've been able to sail. Because how on earth do they think people got to Fiji or Australia or these places? Because I remember once somebody said, oh, well, Papua New Guinea's not that far from Australia. And I was like, what? It's not swimmable. So clearly people were making it out, sailing vessels out of whatever they could do. And I often say this because there are strange sort of blind spots, I think, when we talk about this particular subject, especially in the Pacific, because you've got such a diaspora of islands over such an expanse of water, and there are populations all over the place. And you think, are these the kind of... These can't be the situations where somebody just gets swept there and cast away there, because obviously they've ended up building communities, and therefore usually that takes at least two people, a man and a woman. So there must have been some kind of designed decision to make these journeys. And you can, like you say, I can only imagine what the first person in a canoe paddling about thought when a humpback breached the surface. That, like you say, straight away, that's the greatest monster story anybody's ever told at that particular period of time, because You've no idea what the hell that is, especially out there. Even in your personal experience, you may have come across a few large animals on land, big cats, mm-hmm. or maybe a rhino or an elephant, depending on which continent you're on. But to see something that dwarfs those so powerfully and so gracefully breaching the surface as you're paddling along to this island that somebody in your community may have mentioned to you in passing, it must have absolutely blown their minds. And therefore, you can see the germs of storytelling and legend and lore and folklore. Yes, I know some of them have got the basis in reality and real creatures that we're aware of this day and age. But there's a lot more to some of these, especially when you get into the modern era.
Mm-hmm. Just going back to the Polynesians for a moment, I just wanted to say, I think that the Polynesian exploration of the Pacific is one of the most amazing stories that humanity has ever done. They developed ways to be able to tell from the waves that their boats would encounter, the curvature of the waves. They could tell if they were getting near an island. And they didn't have, most of them didn't have metal because of the, you know, you weren't really able to mine on an island like that. So they were dealing with Stone Age technology, wood, rope, things like that, and they still managed to get all the way across the Pacific and colonize almost every island in the Pacific. Just an amazing story. And I think I mentioned that in the Sea Monsters book a little bit. I wanted to give that a little bit of a shout out.
Yes. Well, I think it's one of those aspects that gets really overlooked. And I think when you shine a light on things like that, it surprises me how little known that really is, because it is remarkable what they achieved with, as you say, the limited resources when comparing it to, say, European and American cultures, who were probably had bigger access to more resources, primarily because, as you say, a lot of these places are quite small atolls and, you know, former parts of volcanoes here and there and the odd caldera. And yet they still, you know, made it thousands of miles. And it's amazing that people who we would perhaps consider, in a modern sense, and obviously not you or I, Christopher, would consider them to be quite lacking in intellect, I think. Because sometimes people base intellect on their ability to build buildings, whereas I think what the Polynesians achieved is far outweighs some of the other achievements that went on after them in the world in regards to what people were doing. It just shows that infinite knowledge of the world around you that I think a lot of people lament that we've lost touch of in the modern era, with us being so technologically tied to our existence these days, that these people were able to use the world around them and the behavior of animals and like you say, noticing how the waves changed when they were approaching land. Is just stuff that blows your mind. And you look at how the Vikings made it across to Greenland and then into Canada. They're just going. And if they hit something, brilliant. And you would think, I wonder what would happen if they hadn't have got there. What is the point where they go, actually, we've been at sea 3 months and we haven't found anything, so shall we go back? But that then is, well, how do they know how to get back? Never mind get to somewhere else. And once you start looking at these achievements of these peoples, I find it absolutely, it just really blows you away of how little credit we give some of these ancient cultures and the forward-thinking abilities they had.
I think that's something that's very important to remember, is that the human intellect and the human spirit is unchanged from a long, long time ago. And just because you don't have modern technology doesn't make you any worse than we are today. You know, every era has its geniuses. Who knows what the genius of that day may have discovered that we've lost over time, just because so many things get lost over time. Even when we try to preserve things, history tends to get buried underneath whatever we build on top of it. I guess we're sort of wandering off into a tangent maybe, but that's cheers for humanity.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm fascinated with the rediscovery of cultures in Central and South America.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you had that incredible discovery, I think, at the tail end of last year, where they discovered a whole city that had been under the jungle for centuries, which has completely changed the history of South America, because they all were considered to be hunter-gatherers. And now they were building things equivalent to what the Egyptians were doing with the pyramids at the same time, mm-hmm. if not earlier. And once again, like you say, I think just because, I mean, because of the expanse of time that's gone on from some of these cultures falling away, you can only imagine what's lurking in certain areas. Perhaps South America is a prime example of that. I would imagine there's very similar situations in certain parts of Asia as well. And we're still discovering these things. And I think, once again, we're dealing with a very small tranche of history here that we are aware of, that we know about, especially in the modern era with the written word, especially in English. I think there are thousands of incredible discoveries still awaiting us there. And that's the wonder of the world, I think. And as we were saying, about these kind of books, because it fires up the imagination that, even as adults, I still feel like a child when I see something like that, because it takes me back to being 10, 11, 12 years old and discovering these subjects for the first time. And it makes you think, as you said earlier, what if, what else is out there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I made sure to donate one set of my author's copies to my daughter's sixth grade class, because I wanted to make sure that some of the target audience definitely had them in their hand. I also recently verified that they were at the local library system in my town, and took a picture of what was in there, and was only able to get three of the books because the other three had been checked out, which is great. I can't take a picture of them for the exact reason that I want, which is that people are reading these things, and hoping that maybe I will inspire the next generation to write the next set of books, 25, 30 years from now as well. Mm-hmm. And who knows what will have been discovered in that time. Maybe they'll have found Bigfoot. Maybe he's just in the next room. Who knows?
Well, yes, who knows? I mean, you only have to look at how people view alternate dimensions these days compared to what they thought 30 years ago, to see that 30 years ago, people had said you were talking madness, then you'd lost your control of your faculties, and now it seems to be a pretty normal conversation in scientific mm-hmm. circles about parallel dimensions running at the same time, which is, you see these changes over the years, and it's remarkable. Mm-hmm. Like you say, you never know. I suppose before I let you leave, Christopher, was there one particular subject that you wish you'd been able to write a book about in this particular collection that you couldn't, that you had a love of? Or is this something that hopefully down the line you may want to revisit and do another six, as I said at the beginning?
Well, I'd love to do something with archaeology. As we were talking about the stories of the past, there's just so much there, and there's so much mystery, and there's so much to interest people in. I think it would be a great addition to this series in whatever way. Because there's so much that I can inspire someone to want to know more about and to hopefully maybe become an archaeologist. I know I wanted to become a paleontologist when I was a kid, in part because of reading stuff like this. And I would love to be able to do that. I'd love to tell more stories about monsters, different kinds of monsters from all over the world. Just barely scratched the surface with what I was able to talk about here, and there's so many different kinds. Vampires, perhaps. There's so many different flavors of vampires from all over the world, and it's interesting how that's a common thread throughout many different cultures, and where does it come from? Why do people believe in this sort of thing? maybe something to do with horror movies too. Zombies, perhaps, yeah.
Ah, another one of my favorite loves. Well, wherever you turn your hand to next, I can't wait. So, for anybody that wants to track down these books and some of your previous writings and articles, as I said in the introduction, you've written on countless subjects, and you have a wonderful way with words where you're able to take us on journeys through the written word, which is always an incredible talent for any writer to hold. Where can they find your work, follow you online, and check your website out?
Well, my publisher's website is the Creative Company. It's a family-run publisher in Mankato, Minnesota. And their website is thecreativecompany.us. They have thousands of children's titles. If you're interested in mine in particular, as I hope you are, the easiest way to get there would be to go to my website, which is christopherbon.com. And right up at the top, I've got a whole section on the Enduring Mysteries books and some of the other things that I've been doing recently.
Brilliant. Well, I shall put links to everything in the show notes. And I just want to say I wish you all the very best with the continued checking out of these books from every library you've possibly be able to get them stocked in. And anything that fires up the enthusiasm of younger people in regards to getting them hooked into these subjects. We may regret that statement 30 years down the line, depending on which rabbit hole they fall down, Christopher. And I just want to wish you the very best. And I look forward to whatever you've got coming down the pipe. Take care and thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun.